Welcome to Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine's podcast series. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine publishes original crime and mystery fiction in six double issues a year. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. Our podcast features readings of short stories from the back issues of our magazine to give you a sense of what the magazine is about. For this episode, Floyd Sullivan reads his story, The Beano, from our September-October 2021 issue. The amateur sleuth in The Beano is the photographer Rick Peters, who can't quiet his curiosity when a recent client is found dead. Rick Peters is also featured in Floyd Sullivan's new novel, Bad Exposure.
A headline in my news feed stopped me cold. Robert Charles found dead in Old Town Home. I read the article and six more on various news outlet websites. All reported much the same story. The wealthy Northside financier had been discovered unresponsive by his cleaning service early that morning. A police spokesman stated that he died of an apparent head wound, but would rule out neither foul play nor an accident. The investigation was ongoing. I texted Martin. Hear about Bob? No. What? Check local news sites. Will do. 5 minutes later, he texted again. Holy S. Cops want to talk to you? Not yet. You? Don't know. In Wisconsin. Gig at Delavan Lake last night. In addition to brokering photography and printing, Martin played in a rock band, an avocation that seemed more important to him as he aged. A month before, he had emailed me about a freelance photo shoot. Robert Charles wanted his collection of famous baseballs photographed by a professional, but it had to be done at his home, not in a studio. He never let his precious collectibles leave his house. How do you know him? I asked Martin as we discussed the job over coffee at a Starbucks. Believe it or not, I met him on Waveland Avenue during a Cubs game maybe 30 years ago. We were ball hawks. Are you familiar with the term? Of course. You can't follow the Cubs or even baseball without seeing the ball hawks on TV. Yeah. We would stand at the corner of Waveland and Kenmore waiting for the home runs to come sailing out of the park and onto the street. Batting practice was great, but then things slowed during the games. We got to talking one day and became friends. This was before he made his fortune. We had the same taste in music and books, and to be honest, women. Get many baseballs? Not me. I wasn't good at it. Gave up on it after a couple of seasons. But Bob could judge a fly ball better than just about anyone. When he saw one in the air over the bleachers, he could run right to the spot where it was going to land. I think he played outfield in high school. That's how he started collecting baseballs? Yep, most of them were worthless BP balls, but every now and then he'd snag a big one, like a game-winning walk-off or a grand slam. Then he'd get the player's autograph and add it to his collection. A lot of players wanted to buy the big ones back from him, or trade autographed jerseys. He rarely made those kinds of deals. He got some bad press about it a couple of times. Bad press? You know, ball hawk refuses to give rookie first home run ball, things like that. The players started hating him and refused to sign the balls, so he'd hire some kid to get the autographs. When he started making a lot of money, he bought balls from other collectors, and he started collecting other stuff. I'm not sure exactly what exactly. We'll see when we get there. Right now, he's only interested in having the baseballs photographed. And if we do a good job, it could mean more work later on, shooting whatever else he collects these days. We agreed on a day rate, and the following week I packed up my Canon DSLR, my laptop, a tripod, a small softbox with flash head, a power pack, several 16x20 white foam core cards, light stands, and a crossbar. A half a roll of white seamless background paper plus the appropriate cords, clamps, tape, scissors, and other basic location equipment. Charles lived on Burling, south of Armitage. A block of huge new mansions that took up 2, 3, 4, or even 5 city lots, replacing the traditional red brick three flats and 19th century worker cottages that used to define Old Town. Billionaire's Row, I thought to myself as I pulled up to his gate and texted Martin that I was there. Charles's home was a modern, boxy, glass-and-steel three-story house with large, square, tinted windows defining its street facade. The gate opened, and I drove down into a spacious underground garage. Martin and Charles emerged from a door to my right. Both were dressed casually in jeans and t-shirts. Charles was tall and lanky, a head higher than Martin. He held out his hand. "Bob Charles," he said. We shook. "Rick Peters," I said. "Martin tells me he used to shoot for a men's magazine," he said as he turned and led us through the door into the house. "Briefly," I said, "many years ago. Must have been fun." "It was work." We walked through a well-outfitted gym, a billiards room, and a home theater to a large metal door with a keypad on a heavy steel handle. As Charles punched a sequence of numbers, I wondered what the rest of the house looked like, but I would never see the floors above the basement. The vault was spacious, larger than most living rooms I had been in, and was a combination safe and showroom. His baseball collection took up one whole wall of five long shelves. Each ball sat in its own clear plexiglass case. Old books lined another wall. Several guitars stood on stands at the back wall, which displayed framed magazines, three of them I recognized as first editions of Playboy, featuring Marilyn Monroe. They looked to be in close to mint condition, considering their age. "Not surprised that those caught your eye," said Charles, "having been in the same business and all." "Everyone who ever worked for a men's magazine knows about that one," I said. "I have another copy that's not in such good shape, if you'd like to page through it." "No thanks." Just above the top of the guitar's tuning pegs hung the broken neck of another, obviously very violently separated from its body. I thought immediately of The Who. "That little curiosity is what got me into collecting in the first place," said Charles. "And it didn't cost me a cent. I was at a Who concert in Algonquin, Illinois, at a teen nightclub called The New Place, a converted barn way out on the Fox River. The stage was outside against a stockade fence. I stood in the barnyard, maybe 20 feet away. I think there was a cornfield behind Keith Moon's drums. The Who were already famous for destroying their equipment at the end of their shows, during my generation. At the end of the song, they repeated two chords over and over, and Moon started a non-stop roll. Pete Townsend took his guitar off his shoulder and started pounding it on the stage. When the neck broke off, he tossed it into the crowd, right to me and maybe five other guys. I was a little taller than they were, so I was able to catch it above their arms and surround it with my body. I fell to the dirt to protect it. They eventually gave up. The Who finished the song, and the crowd began to leave, so the neck was mine. Similar Townsend necks go for six figures these days, but I wouldn't part with mine for any amount of money. The three of us returned to the garage to fetch my equipment. I was surprised that Charles helped lug the stuff into the vault. As I set up on a long table he had placed in the middle of the floor, he and Martin strolled to the collections, Charles describing the provenance of each piece. I paid no attention. When I had connected the camera to my laptop and strobe, I fired off a test to confirm that everything worked. The bright flash stopped Martin and Charles. Charles frowned. "What was that?" he asked. "Making sure all my connections are synced," I said. "Oh, but you really didn't shoot anything, did you?" "Nothing at all." "Please delete the file." He joined me at my laptop and looked at the screen. "Sure." I highlighted the image which showed the random view of the vault and hit the delete. "From your trash as well." I found the discarded file in my trash and permanently deleted it. "Done," I said. They returned to their discussions as I set up the background paper. The photo shoot progressed very efficiently. Charles personally brought down the baseballs from the wall and placed them on the set one at a time. Martin played photo assistant and rotated the balls, adjusted my light, or moved the foam core reflectors as I directed. Once I had the lighting set for one of the white baseballs, we could quickly shoot, pull the ball off the set, and replace it with the next one. But the last ball was stained with a rich brown patina as if it had been used for an entire game. Charles called it the Merkle Ball and explained that it was at the center of a controversial play toward the end of the 1908 season, the last year the Cubs won a World Series until 2016. Many baseball scholars don't believe this ball really exists, but Johnny Evers, you've heard of Tinker to Evers to Chance, haven't you? Hall of Fame double play combination on that Cubs team, I said. He nodded. Johnny Evers claimed that he saved the ball. It was in his family for decades and then sold a number of times. At one point, it was in actor Charlie Sheen's collection. I recently acquired it from a collector who bought it at auction in 2010 for over $75,000. I didn't ask how much he paid for it. Charles seemed very pleased with the images he saw on my laptop. A housekeeper appeared at the door of the vault with a tray that held a bottle of an extremely expensive single malt scotch with three heavy, cut crystal, double old-fashioned glasses. As he poured, Charles asked if I could copy the files to a jump drive then and there, but I convinced him that I would release no images until I had worked on each in Photoshop. We agreed that I would deliver the shots to him personally at his downtown office. The police called me a few hours after Mart and I exchanged texts about Charles's death. "Mr. Peters," said a deep voice with a strong, brittle Chicago accent, much like Studs Terkel, I thought. "We have learned that you recently did some work for Robert Charles." "Yes," I said. "We have been told that you photographed various items of value belonging to Mr. Charles in the vault in his home that houses his various collections." "Yes." "Those collections have been estimated to be worth several $1 million."
"I wouldn't doubt it."
"We are currently trying to determine if Mr. Charles died accidentally or if foul play was involved."
"I understand."
"Foul play would imply that perhaps he was murdered during an attempted robbery, that someone or several individuals intended to steal some of the more valuable items and were interrupted by Mr. Charles, at which time they struggled and he was killed."
When I didn't reply, he continued.
"Our problem is that nothing seems to be missing. He kept a general inventory of his collections that we checked against the objects in the vault. Everything is accounted for. Now," he paused and coughed, "you and a Mr. Martin Colton were identified by Mr. Charles's housekeeper as being the last people to have visited the vault before Mr. Charles's death."
"I have no way of confirming that," I said.
"We don't need you to confirm it, Mr. Peters. What I would like you to do is join me at Mr. Charles's home and help us determine if anything is out of place. That is, does the vault look as it did when you finished your photography project? We contacted his ex-wife, but she lives in Boulder and claims to never have set foot in the house, let alone the vault. They divorced before Mr. Charles had the house built. We are also in touch with Mr. Colton. He is driving back to Chicago from Wisconsin and will meet us at the Charles home at 4 this afternoon. Will you be able to attend?"
I took my cell phone from my ear and checked the time. 2:30.
"Certainly," I said. "Thank you, Mr. Peters."
I took the L to Armitage and walked east to Burling. Martin stood on the sidewalk, leaning against the wrought iron fence in front of the house. He pushed off when he saw me.
"Look at all this crime scene tape, Rick," he said, gesturing at long strands of the yellow plastic tape that ran across the width of the garage and blocked the front door. "If they don't know that there was a crime yet, what's with the tape?"
"I don't know." "When did you get back?"
"About an hour ago."
"We have one more gig tonight. Hopefully we can finish up here quickly so I can get back. Where did you say? Delavan Lake?"
"Yeah, Lake Lone Lodge. We've been there for 3 days. I'm ready to come home."
An unmarked police car pulled up to a fire hydrant and a stocky man with white hair, wearing a crumpled tan gabardine suit, climbed out of the driver's seat. He looked like Studs Terkel, too, I thought. He pulled his wallet out and showed us his badge.
"Detective Talbot, homicide. Thanks for coming. Which of you is Peters?"
I raised my hand slightly.
"Okay, follow me."
He had a remote that opened the gate and the garage doors. He pulled the yellow tape away and led us through the basement to the vault. The thick door was open.
"Don't touch anything," he said, "although I'm sure your prints are already among those we lifted if you worked down here."
I went to the spot where I placed my tripod. "This is where I stood for most of the shoot," I said. Martin walked slowly around the perimeter of the space.
I don't know for sure about the books, he said, but everything else seems to be the same as when we were here. His most valuable baseball, he pointed at the Merkle ball in the middle shelf, is still here.
He turned to the back wall. The Marilyn Monroe Playboys, the Pete Townsend neck, and the other guitars, it all looks the same as when we left after the photo shoot.
You sure? Said Detective Talbot, more as a statement than a question.
Well, said Martin, I didn't memorize everything, but I don't see that anything's missing. He scratched his head. Do you mind my asking how Bob died?
Yes, I do mind, said the cop. The incident is still under investigation.
He turned to me. How about you, Peters?
I didn't look at the collection as closely as Martin, but I can't see that anything is different from the way it was when we were here. Did you inspect the images?
What images?
From the shoot. We photographed every baseball on those shelves. If you compare the images to what's here, you probably can determine if any baseballs are missing.
Is that all you shot, the baseballs?
Yes.
Where are the images?
I delivered them to Mr. Charles at his loop office. They're on a blue and white memory stick. Perhaps he brought it home.
We'll check it out. Thank you both.
Back on the sidewalk, Martin said, I'd offer to buy you a beer, but I gotta get back to Delavan. Please keep me posted if you hear anything more about this.
Will do, I said. Hell of a thing.
Yeah, hell of a thing.
Back on the L, on my way home, I sat staring out the window as the train wound its way through the north side. I hadn't seen that anything was different in Charles's vault, but I had a nagging feeling at the back of my brain that something was off. Off just a little, but still off. It wasn't anything I saw just now, or when we were shooting. It was more something I had seen on my laptop. I entered my apartment and immediately started up my Mac. I quickly went through the entire folder of baseball images, including rejected captures. Nothing out of the ordinary. I sat staring at my screen, wishing I hadn't deleted the image I shot in the vault to test my camera connections. But what about the camera itself? Did I have it set to send all captures directly to my computer, bypassing the Canon's 128 gigabyte memory card? What was my previous booking? I had covered a live event at a Michigan Avenue hotel 2 days before the Charles shoot. I would have saved the images on the card and downloaded them to my computer from the camera. I was sure I hadn't changed the setting. After connecting the Canon to the laptop, I found the memory card's file and opened it, quickly highlighting the first two images, a RAW file and a JPEG captured simultaneously. I opened them in Photoshop. The shot revealed the table before I had set up the background paper and the back wall behind it. The Marilyn Monroes, the Townsend neck, and the other guitars were visible, underexposed in the shadows where the light from the flash had faded in the distance. I zoomed in and worked the dodge and burn tools until I brought out the details of the objects and soon saw what had bothered me during my L ride home. Googling Lake Lawn Lodge, I read that the Lookout Bar featured a band called Norwood beginning at 10 that night. That's Martin's band, I thought, named after Norwood Park, the neighborhood in Chicago's northwest side where he grew up. I closed my laptop, tucked it under my arm, left my apartment, and found my car. The resort's website told me to take the Edens to the toll road north, but Google showed a slowdown from the junction to Libertyville, so I took I-90 instead. I exited at Route 47 and drove north through corn country to Wisconsin. I listened to WXRT to put myself in a rock and roll kind of mood. Lake Lawn Lodge was a large Northwoods resort, all stained timber and shady tree-lined paths among several low buildings, a golf course, and spacious grounds that stretched for 2 miles along the shore of Lake Delavan. I had some time to kill, so I found the Lookout Bar and located what I thought would be the band's dressing room. Finding my way to the lakeside of the hotel, I spent the next hour strolling the very pleasant grounds and decided that the many loud motorboats and jet skis on the water spoiled the serenity of the otherwise pristine setting. The resort had 3 restaurants, so I chose one other than the Lookout and had a nice walleye pike dinner. Martin's band began their set 10 minutes late. I sat in the back of the room and sipped a couple of Leinenkugels. They played a variety of classic rock covers, standard blues, and a couple of tunes that Martin introduced as their own compositions. Their final set ended at 1.
"Rick," said Martin, sitting on a folded chair and sweating profusely from the band's loud and energetic playing, "what the hell are you doing here?"
"You told me you were playing here tonight, so I decided to head up and check out your band. Maybe stay in the hotel overnight."
"Let me see if I can grab a couple of beers. I know the bartender."
"No thanks, I've already had my fill for the night."
"Well, I'm going to get one for myself," he said, standing and smiling. "Watch my axe for me, will you?"
A black guitar case was propped against the wall behind his chair.
While he was gone, I glanced around the small room of cinderblock walls and faded prints of forests and lakes and the stereotyped Indians in buckskins paddling canoes. I nodded at his bandmates and said, "Nice set."
Martin returned with an amber bottle and sat down.
"So what'd you think? How'd you like the set?"
"Loved it. Very tight. Nice mix of tunes. Your guitar sounds better than ever."
"My guitar?" He forced a brief laugh.
"Someone has to play the guitar for it to sound good."
I nodded. "You are great. You hold the band together."
"I have a good rhythm section," he said. The drummer turned to us and said, "Thanks for nothing, Marty. We're out of here. See you in the room. We have a couple of six-packs."
He looked at me. "Come on along," he said.
"Thanks, I just might," I lied. The band left the two of us alone. Martin looked up at me but said nothing.
"Can I take a look at your guitar?" I asked.
"I didn't know you played," he said.
"I don't."
Neither of us moved for a long moment. Then Martin set his beer down and said,
"I didn't kill him. It was an accident. The police report will confirm it."
"It was all about that," I said, gesturing at his guitar. He stood and reached for the case. Setting it on a table, he flipped the latches and raised the top. I looked in.
"I took a shot of the inside of the vault, not on purpose, to test my system.
I deleted it from my laptop, but forgot to delete it from my camera. This guitar," I said, pointing at the case, "was against the wall with the others, in the middle."
"A place of honor," he said. "I noticed it right away."
The guitar looked small. The body was tinted a red sunburst. The names Gibson and Les Paul were visible as logos at the top of the guitar among the tuning pegs. It lay like a corpse in a coffin cushioned by a feathery violet lining.
"He fell and hit his head on that metal door."
"He fell?"
"I called him earlier and asked if he'd like to jam. He has a studio in the basement. He could play a little bit. When I got there, I asked to see the guitars in the vault again, even though I brought my own guitar. He let us in, then offered me a beer. The housekeeper was gone for the day, so he fetched the drinks himself. I went to the back of the vault and picked up this one." He waved his hand at the guitar case. I met him near the door. When he saw me with the guitar, he went nuts. He dropped the beer and tried to take the guitar away from me. He was screaming, "Do you know what that guitar is? You can't touch it. You can't play it."
I knew what it was, what it is. He touched the strings. "They call it the Beano."
"Beano?
You know who Eric Clapton is, I assume." I nodded. "In 1966, he recorded an album with John Mayle and the Blues Breakers. He used this guitar, a 1960 Gibson Les Paul Standard. His playing on that record defined the sound of rock guitar for decades. What was a poor seller for Gibson when it was in production became the most coveted guitar in music because the Standard model was discontinued in 1960. Any Standard made between 1958 and 1960 will fetch up to $500,000 these days."
"So what makes this one so special?"
"There must be more of them out there."
"Sure, but not like this one."
"The Beano.
It's known as the Beano because in the picture on the album cover, Clapton is reading a copy of a comic book called The Beano. Anyway, Clapton quit Mayle's band to form Cream, the first power trio supergroup. During Cream's early rehearsals, it was stolen from their studio. No one knew what happened to it for decades. Rumors had it hidden in a Manchester basement for several years until the thief needed some money and sold it to a German collector who claimed to have Beatles stuff from their years in Hamburg. From there, it supposedly made its way to L.A., where a failed rock star was rumored to have played it on an album that was never released. Then, a couple of years ago, an article in Guitar Player magazine quoted the blues guitarist Joe Bonamassa as saying it was somewhere on the East Coast. Bob knew all the collectors and tracked it down. And paid $500,000 for it? Martin laughed loudly. Are you kidding? That's how much your garden variety standard might cost you. This is the fucking Beano, the guitar of all guitars. Finding the Beano is like discovering the true cross. You can't put a value on it. He paused and looked up at me. I just wanted to play it. I had no intention of stealing it. But Bob went ballistic. He screamed something about Clapton's fingerprints being intact, and I was going to ruin its provenance. He calmed down for a minute and explained that he had the prints lifted and knew an L.A. cop who could confirm them from when Clapton was busted for drugs in 1968. Bob knew everybody, or could buy anything. He took a swig of beer. The bottle broke. There was beer all over the floor. Bob reached for the guitar and slipped. He hit his head on that door. He lay there and didn't move. I put the guitar back and tried to revive him, but his eyes were open and empty, just staring into nothing. I searched for a pulse but couldn't find one. His neck, his wrist, nothing. I panicked and started to leave, but then I remembered the guitar. So yes, I stole it. But it was already stolen, wasn't it? I put my guitar in its place, and my guitar is no piece of shit. A 1967 ES-335 TD. Almost collectible in its own right. Almost. You gonna turn me in? No, and I'm not gonna tell your story to the cops. That's up to you. Then why are you here? I guess I just wanted to know. 10 days later, I heard from Martin. He emailed that the coroner's verdict was accidental death and that he took the trouble to have the Beano examined by another collector. The registration number had been altered. Someone had changed a digit to put the number within Gibson's 1960 production sequence, the year the Beano was made. Close inspection found that Bob's standard Les Paul was actually manufactured in 1958, 2 years before Clapton's. Clapton never noted the full registration number. Why should he? He bought the guitar for the equivalent of $300 years before he became a guitar god. How Bob had missed the registration number forgery was anyone's guess. Maybe he was just too anxious, too ready to believe in the true cross, wrote Martin in the email. Bob's obituary listed a sister in Indianapolis as next of kin. I contacted her and told her I had recently worked with her brother and would like to drive down there to talk about him and his collection. Are you a collector? Yes, I lied. Well, okay. Maybe you can help me figure out what to do with all that stuff. Driving back to Chicago after meeting with Bob's sister, I pulled into a gas station near West Lafayette and called Martin while I filled my tank. Hey, you still owe me a beer. What's this about, Rick? He asked, his voice subdued. Beer, I said. Actually, I'd like to talk about getting paid for the baseball shoot. Paid? Bob is dead. I sure as hell didn't get paid. I understand, but you are in possession of a very valuable guitar worth $500,000, even if it isn't the Beano. When he didn't reply, I said, I'm not looking for a piece of the action, but I'd like to cover my expenses. The nozzle shut off. I pulled it out of my car and replaced it on the pump. Where are you? He said. Sounds like you're outside. I'm at a gas station. Okay, where should we meet? Tiny Lounge? That's fine. I'll be there at 6-ish. We have a gig down the street at Martyrs at 9. Sounds good. My cell phone told me it was 3:17, giving me 2.5 hours to get from North Central Indiana to Montrose and Lincoln. It would be tight, but I thought I could make it if I survived the speed traps on I-65 near Merrillville. Martin sat at a tall boy table near the front window, biting his nails. He didn't see me enter the bar. I said hello to Jesse, the bartender, who immediately went to the line of taps and pulled me a daisy cutter. I thanked him, took my beer, and stood behind Martin. Nasty habit, I said. Nervous? He turned in his chair. Hey, he said. Have a seat. I see you already have a beer. A rocks glass filled with ice and something clear sat on the table in front of him. He looked at the nails on his left hand. Not nervous. I forgot my nail clipper. Have to keep these short so I don't buzz the strings.
I sat. He looked unkempt and he was sweating.
Sorry about this, I said.
No problem. I understand.
I sipped my beer.
I lied about looking to get paid, I said. I've been doing a lot of lying lately, which is not quite right because I haven't done anything wrong.
And I have?
He took a long pull on his drink.
I hope this isn't about the guitar, because that case is closed, so to speak.
He forced a laugh.
I just got back from Indianapolis.
What's down there?
Bob's sister.
Oh, did you try to hit her up for payment?
She's his only heir, so maybe I should have.
She can certainly afford to pay you.
She also gets his mail and has access to his email and phone accounts.
He shrugged.
You see, Martin, it was your email about the registration number that got me thinking.
What in hell are you talking about?
Bob would have noticed a forged registration number. Anyone who would go to the trouble of having fingerprints identified would have looked very closely at everything on that guitar.
Fingerprints? Remember the cop in L.A., Clapton's drug bust?
Make your goddamn point, Rick.
I asked Bob's sister about any special mail or email that came to Bob after he died. At first, she didn't remember anything out of the ordinary, bills and junk mail mostly. But then she recalled a letter that came in a plain white envelope with an L.A. postmark and no return address. She opened it. You can probably guess what it said.
No, you tell me.
A single sheet of paper with two handwritten lines.
Prince match. What next?
Doesn't mean a thing.
You never had the guitar looked at by another collector, did you?
He didn't answer.
Tell me something, Martin. If you've been lying about everything about the Beano, why should I believe you when you say you didn't kill Bob?
Like I said, doesn't mean a thing. Coroner says accidental death.
I lifted my glass and took a drink, but didn't take my eyes off him.
He stared down into his drink.
So what are you going to do now? Play the Beano again tonight at Martyrs?
What good does that do you?
You can't tell anyone you have it, not even the boys in your band. Word would get around.
You can't sell it to Eric Clapton.
He already owns it.
I guess you could put it in a vault and show it to collectors now and then. A vanity thing.
I just wanted to play it. I don't need to show it to anyone. And you know what? I've already played it, and it was sweet.
Something like making love to Marilyn Monroe?
Better.
Jesse came to our table and asked about our drinks. Martin ordered us another round.
But don't worry, Rick. I won't kill you,
he whispered, and leaned back in his chair. He reached for his first drink and drained the last drops. He put the glass down on the table and stood.
Changed my mind. Don't need that second drink.
Here. He reached into his pocket and took out some loose bills.
This one's on me,
he said as he slapped two 20s on the table.
I can afford it.
He forced another laugh and walked out the door.
Jesse arrived with our second round. I sat and nursed my beer for about 10 minutes, debating whether I should walk down to Martyrs. I decided to go home.
I stood and said thanks to Jesse and started for the door. A waitress came to the table to clear the glasses.
Excuse me, sir, she called.
I turned.
You forgot your guitar.
She pointed to a black Gibson case propped against the wall under the table.
Thank you, Floyd Sullivan, for reading your story, The Beano, from the September-October 2021 issue of Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine is published by Dell Magazines and Penny Publications. To learn more about us, we urge you to go to our website, themysteryplace.com, or look for us on Facebook. You can find essays and writing by our authors at our blog, traceevidence.net. That's trace-evidence.net. This podcast was produced with the help of our senior managing editor, Jackie Sherbo, and editorial assistant, Kevin Wheeler. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. Thanks for listening.